For details, call 408-298-5437. On Friday, December 31st, from 8 p.m. to 2 a.m., a New Year's Eve roller disco party with New Wave Dance Floor will be held at Cell Space, 2015 Bryant Street in San Francisco. The event is 21 and up only, and admission is $10. Disco and New Wave attire is encouraged. For details, call 415-820-3907. The community calendar is produced by members of the KPFA Apprenticeship Program. Send your listing at least 3 weeks in advance to KPFA Box 51, 1929 Martin Luther King Jr. Way in Berkeley, California, 94704. Fax them to 510-848-3812. Attention to the community calendar. Or email us at calendar@kpfa.org. Tell us if your event is wheelchair accessible. To hear this calendar again, call 510-848-6767, extension 621. This calendar is also online at kpfa.org.
Hello, this is Danny Glover, and you listen to my station, where if you want to know, you got
to
be.
You're listening to KPFA, 94.1 in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, and 88.1 KFCF in Fresno.
This is Walter Turner, your host for Africa Today, a weekly program of news, analysis, and discussion about the African continent and African issues. Each week, we'll take a look at different countries and issues on the African continent that define the history and the future of the diverse African experience. Join us.
The country of Egypt is located in Northeast Africa. It has a population of about 85 million, bordered by the Red Sea, the Mediterranean Sea, Sudan, and Libya. During its period of independence, starting in the 1950s, Egypt has had four presidents. Hosni Mubarak, who succeeded Anwar Sadat after his assassination in 1981, has now been president for five terms. Egypt is the largest recipient of United States foreign aid, second only to the country of Israel. Much of Egypt's aid is military and designed to serve broader strategic interests in the Middle East and the Horn of Africa. The Mubarak government has had increasing closer ties with the West, especially the United States. There are new presidential elections slated for 2011, and there have been a lot of limits and attempts to control opposition candidates, particularly the Muslim Brotherhood. The parliamentary elections, which happened this year, 2010, were marked by protests, the elimination of election observance, and a citizenry responding to high levels of unemployment and rising food prices. Joining Africa Today to discuss recent developments in Egypt is Dr. Stephen Zunes. He's a professor in the Department of Politics at the University of San Francisco. He is the author, co-author, along with Jacob Mundy, of Western Sahara, War, Nationalism, and Conflict Irresolution. That's on Syracuse University Press. He serves as a senior policy analyst for the Foreign Policy in Focus project of the Institute for Policy Studies. He's also an associate editor of Peace Review and chair of the Academic Advisory Committee for the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict. Professor Zunes, thanks for joining Africa Today.
It's great to be on.
You have a new book on Western Sahara, which I promoted in the title there. Give us just one or two key points about what that book looks at, Dr. Zunes.
Well, it's the most comprehensive coverage of that conflict in the English language for at least 25 years. It's about, it talks about how Morocco, backed by the United States and France, invaded and occupied that country on the verge of its independence from Spain in 1975, and has maintained a brutal occupation ever since in violation of a whole series of UN Security Council resolutions, a landmark World Court decision, and ongoing resistance, initially an armed struggle, but more recently a largely nonviolent struggle by the people in the occupied territory. And it raises a lot of questions about not just the struggle itself, but broader questions about international law and colonialism and human rights and related concerns.
Why has the tension increased there? I know there was a ceasefire in 91 after the period you talk about with the war, with the Polisario movement. There have been proposals for Western Sahara to be part of Morocco with some degree of quote-unquote autonomy, whatever that means. But in the last period or so, the tensions have gotten worse, and there's been demonstrations in other parts of Europe.
Oh yeah, the repression is certainly gotten worse. As with Israel and its occupied territories, the Moroccans are bringing in large numbers of settlers. Over half the population is still in of Western Sahara. The indigenous population are still in refugee camps in Algeria. The Polisario, which was the armed national liberation movement, had agreed to a ceasefire in return for an internationally supervised referendum on the fate of the territory, where people could decide between independence and integration with Morocco. But Morocco refused to allow the referendum to come forward. And because of threats of an American and French veto, the United Nations Security Council was unable to enforce its resolutions. The Moroccans have proposed a so-called autonomy plan, but not only does it is quite limited in scope, but it would, by definition, preclude even the option of independence, which if indeed they got away with this, it would be the first time that the international community would recognize a country expanding its territory by military force, and with a non-self-governing territory being denied the right of self-determination. So there's some important legal precedents involved here that goes well beyond the fate of the people of Western Sahara itself.
Before we jump into the topic of Egypt, I think I've spoken with you before about Somalia, and you've written extensively about Africa, North Africa, and Sub-Saharan Africa. Is there something that, other than perhaps the larger percentage of the population being Muslims, or perhaps a vision toward the Middle East rather than towards Sub-Saharan Africa, is there something that really distinguishes you're looking at North Africa versus the rest of the African continent, which is sometimes referred to as Sub-Saharan Africa?
Well, I mean, I back in the 80s, I was very active in the anti-apartheid struggle and in other solidarity work with Southern Africa, and I've taught African politics and the like. But in more recent years, as I have gotten a little more Middle East centered in my work, I focused more on North Africa than the rest of the continent. Just a little aside, it's noteworthy that the Arab world has largely turned its back on the people of Western Sahara, largely supporting the Moroccan monarchy, but the African Union has overwhelmingly come into support of Western Sahara, making the Western Saharan government in exile a full member state of the African Union, and they've really been in the forefront of international efforts to end the Moroccan occupation.
Okay. This closeness that you talk about in one of your recent articles about the closeness between Egypt and the United States, what is it based on, Dr. Zunis?
It's basically Egypt as the most populous country in the Middle East and the second most populous country in Africa. It is, and of course, the guardian of the Suez Canal and the where Asia and Africa come together. I mean, strategically, and in many other ways, it's a very important country. And since the late 1970s, when Sadat abandoned the quasi-socialist policies of his predecessor Gamal Abdel Nasser, and switched sides in the Cold War to ally of the United States, it has been a major strategic ally of the United States, receiving close to $2 billion in economic and military assistance, more than any other country except Israel. And basically, we have set up a classic dependency situation where we've pushed an export-oriented economy at the expense of self-sufficiency. So they are even more and more dependent on the United States for very basic needs. countries, including their huge food deficit, which is made up in part by large amounts of U.S. grown wheat. There have been all sorts of joint military exercises and trainings and U.S. bases and major cooperation on a whole number of levels.
The this is one of the first places that Obama spoke. He spoke Africa a couple occasions. He spoke in Cairo, and then he spoke in the country of Ghana. And as I noted in the intro, Hosni Mubarak, since the assassination of Anwar Sadat, has been elected, I believe, 5 terms, and there's a thought he's going to go for another term in 2011. How do you characterize the rule of Mubarak? Is it divided into periods, or there's one key theme?
The key theme is that it's been authoritarian, that none of these elections have been free and fair by any definition. Parliamentary elections just a couple weeks ago were a total sham. Political dissent is suppressed. The press is largely controlled. There are thousands of political prisoners. You've had dissident bloggers and others who have been beaten and tortured to death. It's not a pretty situation, to put it mildly. And despite all the talk by the Bush administration and subsequently of supporting freedom and democracy in the Arab and Islamic world, we seem to have very few qualms about propping up this dictatorship.
It's gone on for a period of time. I mean, there's essentially been almost a permanent state of emergency.
Quite literally, there is a state of emergency that's been in effect. When Mubarak came to office, and it's been renewed regularly every few years, and it remains 30 years later, still in effect.
Does something give you the impression, Dr. Zunes, that the situation is getting worse, or it's escalating, or that the tensions are increasing?
Well, this election was even more of a sham than others, in the sense that it wasn't even subtle. Not only did they deny the presence of international observers, they wouldn't even allow independent civil society groups in Egypt to observe their own election. There was very open ballot stuffing, multiple voting in pro-government precincts, shutting people out from voting in anti-government precincts, stolen ballots. I mean, you name it. I mean, it was anti-government people, being beaten up, thousands of arrests in the weeks leading up to the elections, and increased censorship. I mean, the government it clearly must feel like it's being threatened, because it hadn't come down this hard in many, many years. Indeed, what we're seeing is a very impressive growth of civil society organizations that not only oppose the Mubarak regime, but aren't very supportive of the traditional Muslim Brotherhood opposition. These are large. It's a country that has a very large population of young people who are frustrated with the corruption, the growing economic inequality, the lack of opportunity, and we're seeing a dramatic growth of pro-democracy movements, of trade union activity, of women's groups, human rights groups, others. I mean, some people speculate that Egypt, in fact, may be the site of the next people power, nonviolent pro-democracy insurrection, like we've seen from Serbia to the Philippines and in a couple dozen other countries. Because the social tensions are definitely growing, and it seems to be the regime is starting to run scared.
There's a lot of money put into the military. The figures I looked at, $1.3 billion. Does that not run the risk of either something happening internally with military seizing more power, or the military responding to civil society unrest and concern with just brutal total force.
There's no question that our tax dollars, which pay for this largesse of military equipment, is increasing the repressive capability of the state, and strengthening the role of the military in politics and society. And of course, there's also the risk, as we saw with the Shah of Iran, that if we continue backing the regime as it becomes more and more unpopular, and the United States becomes more and more identified, with the repression and corruption and injustice of the regime, that all those weapons could conceivably end up in the hands of a revolutionary government that's not too friendly to the United States or its interests.
I was reading an article, I think it was in Marip Reports, and the author, I think, identified two or three key issues. And one, this along with reading your report, was the increasing ties, financial and political, with the country of Israel, particularly around the issue of the Sinai in terms of investment, in terms of attitudes against organizations like Hamas. How big of a factor are Egyptian relationships with Israel in this dynamic?
Well, the large-scale U.S. Military and economic aid to Egypt began after the Camp David Accord of 1978, the peace accord that Sadat signed with the Israelis. And it's interesting that in many ways it was almost as much of a tripartite military pact as it was a peace agreement. Because when most countries have peace agreements, the military spending goes down. Military procurement lessens because, there's less a threat of war. But as far as this deal, military procurement by both countries went way up. And the United States has been spending about $5 billion a year to both Israel and the Egypt every year ever since. And part of the deal is that the United States presses Egypt to cooperate on a whole series of economic and strategic and political concerns. In fact, the United States has never made a conditional on human rights, or free elections or anything like that. A couple years ago, Congress had a provision that made part of the aid conditional on Egypt cracking down on movement between Egypt and the Gaza Strip. In other words, tightening that rather draconian embargo and sanctions, quarantine on that impoverished enclave of the Gaza Strip. So there are definitely strings attached, and definitely cooperation with Israel is part of it.
We'll get back directly to Egypt. Is Egypt expected to have a role in the developments that are going on in Sudan also? I mean, are they a supporter of the government of Northern Sudan, Omar al-Bashir? How does that play out? Is that of any importance to Egypt and the United States?
There's actually a fair amount of bad blood between Egypt and Sudan. Because back in the 50s, when Sudan was about to become independent, Egypt didn't want it to become independent. In fact, they wanted the Arab part of the country to be part of Egypt. Indeed, it was jointly administered by the British and the Egyptian government. In fact, the official name was Anglo-Egyptian Sudan during the later part of the colonial period. So, and also the secular government of Mubarak is concerned about the Islamist orientation of the regime in Khartoum, and in fact there were some elements tied to the government that attempted to assassinate Mubarak on a visit to Addis Ababa about 10 or 12 years ago, which led to the first round of UN sanctions on that country. So I'm sure the United States would like Egypt to have some influence on Sudan. I think there's too much bad blood between the two for them to be able to do much.
You talked about the youth in the country of Egypt, and you talked about the unemployment rates and this kind of fatigue with the process. A couple questions together. Is Mubarak planning to run again in 2011? Is his son going to run? And secondly, the opposition, the Waf Party, the Muslim Brotherhood. There have been concerns about the Muslim Brotherhood has some commitment to nonviolence, which is not necessarily clear to me. And then there's the gentleman who was formerly with the Atomic Energy Agency who's come back, who wants to play a role perhaps in Egypt. Talk about those couple of things together. They're the opposition and the potential for next year's election.
The Waft Party was the original nationalist party that led the largely nonviolent independent struggle against the British in 1919 and then the early 1920s. They're fairly conservative. Their leadership is pretty elderly at this point. Don't have much falling among the youth, and they've also cut a few deals with the regime that have made much of the pro-democracy movement skeptical of them. The Muslim Brotherhood is technically illegal, but they do operate. They have run candidates not as Muslim Brotherhood, but as independents. They gained a fair number of seats in the most recently parliamentary election, but due to government shenanigans, they pretty much lost them all this latest round. The Muslim Brotherhood is committed to working within the political process. The more extremist elements had moved away from Brotherhood some years ago, formed their own groups, engaged in some horrific acts of terrorism during the 1980s and particularly in the early 90s. And so, the Muslim Brotherhood has been going out of its way to come across as moderate and legitimate, but still, it's a pretty conservative Islamist party. But among the younger Egyptians, with some exceptions, of course, while generally observant and would like to see Islamic values more incorporated in certain ways, these are not fundamentalists. Certainly do not support the extremists, but also they see the Brotherhood, like the Wafda, as part of the old guard that have been too quick to compromise, that don't really seem to have much fresh blood or new ideas, and so I think we're seeing more of a third force. Now there's some hope that Mohamed El-Baradei, the Nobel Peace Prize winning former head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, could unify an opposition of secular Democrats, moderate Islamists, and other pro-democracy forces. But the government made it pretty clear that they would not allow him to run, and at least under conditions that would be even remotely fair. But he is getting a fair amount of support, and could be a figure that could unify the disparate elements of the population if indeed he was allowed to run. But at this point, he's calling for a boycott of the presidential election because it's real obvious that the components that would make a free and fair election possible simply are not there. Rather, it be Mubarak, who's already well into his 80s, running for yet another term, or he tries to put his son in power, a son who is not at all popular, that is not considered particularly capable of leading, and of course negates the whole purpose of the Egyptian Revolution back in 1952, which was to end the monarchy and end the republic, not one of where succession goes from father to son.
So what does this third force, we're speaking with Professor Stephen Zunes. He is a professor in the Department of Politics, University of San Francisco, co-author with Jacob Amundi. Book is Western Sahara, War, Nationalism, and Conflict Irresolution. Please take a look at it. It's a topic that's written on too often. And where do you post many of your blogs or your weekly writings, Professor Zunes?
You can find my own website, which is www.stephenzunes.org. Stephenzunes. Most of my writing also gets on my blog on the Huffington Post.
Okay, Huffington Post. So what would this third force look like? I say this because you've talked about a number of different elements. You've talked about civil society. You've talked about young people. You talked about Mohamed El-Baradei. You've talked about those people who, you know, were part of the food rebellions of 2008. You've talked about more militant opposition. You've talked about conservative. I mean, who makes up this third force?
And I would add to that. Trade unionists. There have been over 30 years. There have been over 3,000 strikes, workplace occupations, and other militant action by trade unionists. Much has been brutally suppressed, but a whole series of strikes and actions, including a continual sit-in by government buildings, last year, forced the government to freeze its privatization campaign. Hundreds of public industries had been privatized in recent years, but Mubarak suspended that. Independent trade union trade unions have been recognized for the first time as a result of some strikes and some wage concessions have been given. But the economic situation is actually quite desperate right now. I mean, the minimum wage has not been raised in literally decades, and while inflation has continued to rise. So I mean, a lot of what's going on is a lot of bread and butter kinds of issues. I mean, young people can't afford to buy an apartment or even rent one, and if you can't do that, it's very hard to get married. The frustration is growing among urban youth. What we've been seeing is an increased use of the internet. About 2 years ago, they had what they called the Facebook Revolution, where some young people, not only with the opposition of the government, but the opposition of the Muslim Brotherhood, had a one-day general strike that was nearly 50% effective, the largest general strike in decades, that was largely organized through Facebook. We're starting to see this growing militancy, again, that's for pragmatic reasons is dedicated to strategic nonviolent action, which has actually been more effective than armed revolution in recent years in terms of toppling dictators. But they still face an uphill battle because we are talking about a well-armed and well-organized repressive government.
Did Obama make any statement in our last minute and a half here? Did Obama make any statement about the recent parliamentary elections or Secretary of State Hillary Clinton?
The State Department and White House issued statements that were very mild. We are concerned about the fairness, kind of thing, but there's no threat of cutting off aid or anything like that. I mean, the opposition, the pro-democracy opposition, has been very disappointed with Obama, that they really believe that his continued support for the regime is what's emboldened this crackdown, because the government feels they have nothing to lose, no matter how repressive they are. And fortunately, Obama's been proving them right.
For the last 27, 28 minutes, we've been speaking with Professor Zunes, Stephen Zunes, Dr. Stephen Zunes, professor in the Department of Politics, University of San Francisco. Take a look at his upcoming book with Jacob Mundi, Western Sahara, War, Nationalism, and Conflict Irresolution. I like that title, Irresolution. www.stephenzunes.org, stephenzunes.org. You can take a look at his writings. Also, usually post up on the Huffington Post. Does a good job of covering North Africa, and we always appreciate having a chance to talk with you, Professor Zunis.
My pleasure being on your show again.
Thank you. The country of Mozambique is located in southern Africa, has a population of more than 20 million. During the 16th century, the country was colonized by the country of Portugal and remained under Portuguese colonial control until the collapse of the Portuguese central government in 1975. The years after that were marked by a destabilization campaign led by South Africa, which included the United States and the country of Zimbabwe, then called Rhodesia. Economic developments have been uneven, with the institution of at times socialism, donor-driven market economy, and economic prescriptions instituted by the IMF after the 1990s. We're joined in the studio by Dr. Julie Cliff, an Australian-born physician and public health specialist who moved to Mozambique from Tanzania in the mid-1970s. In Mozambique, she's been the head of the Infectious Disease Unit in the Central Teaching Hospital and epidemiology. Now pronounce that correctly a moment, in the Ministry of Health. She currently teaches on the faculty, a Master of Public Health course at Eduardo Mondlane University in Maputo. Her main areas of work have been in diseases related to eating cassava, specifically the paralytic disease Konzo. Konzo primarily affects women of reproductive age and children and is a neglected disease of the poorest rural woman in Africa. She is currently here in the United States working as a Hesperian fellow, updating the well-known book, Where There Is No Doctor. Dr. Cliff, thanks for joining Africa Today.
Thanks very much.
Good. The word I mispronounced, how do you pronounce that?
Epidemiology.
And what's how?
Epidemiology. Yeah.
Epidemiology. And what does it translate for us?
Basically, it's the study of populations.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And disease in populations.
Okay. What brings you to the San Francisco Bay Area?
Basically, I'm here with Hesperian because I adapted the book Where There Is No Doctor for Mozambique, and that's a Portuguese edition. And now Hesperian's doing a new edition in English, so I'm working on that, bringing some of the insights from adapting the Portuguese edition.
Okay, how long of a journey has this been, this book process?
An extremely long journey. Okay. Too long in many ways.
Okay.
It took us 9 years to do the book in Mozambique.
Okay. And how many copies has that book sold around the world? A lot, has it not?
It's sold about 2 million. It's been translated into over 50 languages. It's incredible.
And that's what Hesperian does, basically. They work around, correct me if I'm wrong, around health issues.
Yeah, they work around health issues, and they work around producing books and on health issues.
And how has the book been used in, how are you using it in Mozambique, because you could use it in Mozambique and you could use it in Angola, but then you'd have to have a different edition for the English-speaking countries. How is it being used by the Mozambique Health Services?
Basically, we gave a lot of copies to the Mozambican Health Services.
Okay.
And we wrote it for the primary health care workers, so the people in the most peripheral places who don't normally have access to a lot of material. And it's being used by them for consultation, it's being used for training, it's being used also for continuing education. So in places where there are fairly low literacy levels, one person's reading it and then explaining it to other people.
Okay. What's the impetus for you leaving Australia, going to Tanzania, and then going to Mozambique? What happened here?
Basically, it was the 1970s,
okay,
which you lived through, which was a very difficult political time, when people of the left went and worked in countries like Mozambique, newly independent African countries. So I went really because of that.
But you first went to Tanzania?
Yes, I first went to Tanzania because at that time you couldn't go to Mozambique. So I first went to Tanzania because at that time Tanzania was a country of great promise. You had President Nyerere, very great leader there. And so I went there because I thought it was a country where I could do good work. And it was purely coincidental that while I was there, Mozambique got independence.
Okay. So you were a political person.
Yes, I was a political person.
Okay, you weren't just coming, I just want to help because I want to help. It was, you know, I have my politics and you have a certain... What was your thoughts about what was happening in Africa in that period of history that excited Julie?
Yeah, at that time it was, and it still is. You know, Africa is still exciting. It never stops being exciting, no matter what happens. But what excited me was, I think, the policies in Tanzania, which I saw the government there as trying to build a more equal society, was doing an exemplary job with health services, expanding health and education. And at the same time, you had countries like Tanzania who'd recently got independence and who were doing exciting things. And you had the dreadful situation in Southern Africa. Had Rhodesia still in place, apartheid still in place. And at that time, you know, we had the countries of the front line who were supporting the liberation movements and the anti-apartheid movement. And Tanzania was one of those countries.
Mm-hmm. Your first impressions when you get to Mozambique in the 1970s?
It was overwhelmingly exciting. But that's because I went to Mozambique for the independence celebrations. So I actually went 3 days before independence from Tanzania. So I witnessed the independence of Mozambique. And I think that's a once-in-a-lifetime experience, to be in a country that's gaining independence.
These phases that the country of Mozambique has gone through, from the independence phase to the phase of the all-out war, RENAMO, against the country of Mozambique and Southern Africa, the phases of socialism, the phases of the IMF prescriptions. Talk a bit about what you've seen unfold as you've been in Mozambique, just in terms of how Mozambique has responded to essentially building a new country.
Yeah, it's been a roller coaster in some ways, ups and downs, and I've lived through it now for over 30 years. So basically after independence, there was a period of great euphoria, but also was very exciting from the point of view of a health worker, because we were building a new health service. And that was also the time internationally when there was a big push to develop primary healthcare services. So the independence of Mozambique coincided rather nicely with that international mood. So I was there when we built a primary health service. Then through the years of attack by the South Africans, when a lot of the health services were destroyed, but the morale still held up. And I think that's one of the lessons for me, that if you build something that's good, no matter what happens, it's actually quite hard to destroy. So I lived through the war and then the kind of chaotic period of rebuilding after the war, when Mozambique was very donor dependent and still is. And as you said, also part of that donor dependence was that it had to stick to IMF policies. So, for example, we couldn't rebuild the health services. We could rebuild the health services after the war, but we couldn't expand them. And as the war started, at a time when the health services were still being expanded, these limitations were very tough. Very tough. I hope I've made that clear.
Yeah,
well, I'm not sure.
But what does it require? I mean, what we're going to work into your public health work, to be a person who's dedicated to the health of people and to be in a situation where you have to deal with the reality that you don't have the resources to be able to put things in place. Mm-hmm. Because I traveled to Mozambique during the war. Mm-hmm. War is devastating. So I'm asking a couple of questions there. Making it through the war, 1 million people killed, 2-3 million people lose their lives. But at the same time, as a doctor, as a medical person, having to deal with the reality, the country really doesn't have the resources and we desperately need them.
Yeah, no, it's extremely tough. But I think there's two things that help you deal with these situations. One is that in Mozambique, things happen slowly. You know, like the war built up slowly, so you kind of slowly adjusted to it. I think the other thing is a kind of a fantastic spirit of resistance. Like, we knew that war was coming from South Africa, and we knew, therefore, that one was on the right side, because it was South Africa that was fomenting it. And although during the war it never really seemed that hopeful that apartheid was going to end, in fact, one did feel one was on the right side of history and that apartheid had to end. So that was a help, I think. But also, I think I'm sustained by the spirit of the Mozambican people. You know, people there don't lose heart. They keep trying. They keep doing things. So there's always been a spirit to sustain that's helped in all these very difficult times.
So you really are. You're a Mozambican now, aren't you?
I don't have Mozambican nationality. I'm Australian, but I've lived there for so long.
That's a long time.
I feel Mozambican.
That's a long time to live someplace and to not be that in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, no, I feel Mozambican. I really do. Yeah,
I was just speaking with your friend, Joseph Hanlon. Mm. We talk with Joe all the time about political issues. And when I mentioned I was talking to you, he said, I know this person. I found the story about the Konzo fascinating. I was reading it last night. I found this whole process, and there's a picture of you in there, and I guess some of this is in like the late 1970s, and then it becomes difficult, et cetera. Tell us the story about Konzo and the process there, with some brevity, of course, of discovering it and trying to deal with it and the hurdles.
Yeah, basically, in 1981, I was working in the Ministry of Health, and we got a message that there was a strange epidemic of a paralyzing disease. And the first thoughts was that this might be polio. But as soon as we went to investigate, we realized that it wasn't. It was some strange new disease. And it was absolutely terrible, because there are over 1,000 people paralyzed over a huge geographic area, something we didn't know what the cause was. But that was a time when the Mozambican health services were really very well organized. So they organized, go out, find the cases. We did all the usual epidemic investigations. And there was a very bad drought in the area. Now, I'm an infectious diseases specialist, so I was thinking in infectious diseases. And I'll always remember in one of my first interviews with people there, they said, this is the cassava we're eating. It's gone bitter. There's something wrong with it. And we ignored that. Not exactly ignored it, but we didn't put it center stage. And that was only when all the infectious disease results came back and they were all negative. We thought of that, and we asked to measure cyanide levels, because we'd sent the bloods off to a lab outside. And they came back the highest that had ever been recorded. So basically this whole area was suffering from mass cyanide poisoning, and some people had been paralyzed as a result. But it was from eating the crop they live on, cassava, which is one of the main crops of the developing world.
How is cyanide getting into the crop?
The cyanide is in the crop. Cyanide's a brilliant defense mechanism against insects. And a lot of plants have it. You know, there's over 2,000 plants that have got cyanide in. But cassava's the main, the only food that humans eat in quantity that's got a lot of cyanide. And not all cassava has cyanide. Only bitter cassava has cyanide. But that deals with drought better than the other types of cyanide.
And why were people I mean, as the cassava plant continues to grow, does it lose some of its cyanide or no?
No.
So how do people, in the story there, it talks about a process where if you added water to it or mashed it, it became less cyanide. Mm. How do people, why do they find themselves eating the crop?
Basically, people process it. They know they have to get the cyanide levels down. Okay. But that's hard to do, and it's hard to do quickly because in the areas of Africa, although I'm not exactly correct here, because in Mozambique, they sun-dry cassava because that doesn't take much labor. It's fairly simple. But in the Congo, for example, where they've got a lot of Konza paralysis, they don't sun-dry it. They put it in water to leach the cyanide out. But under conditions of stress, if you're starving, you don't take the time. You've got to eat. So you don't have time to go through the process of detoxifying it. And we've found a neat new method where you can detoxify it quickly. And we're now trying to introduce this in the areas that have got Konza. Because I'm afraid, 30 years later, Konza's still happening in Africa.
What are the problems of having enough food, of the rural areas being able to produce enough food for consumption? What's the connections, or are there connections between the IMF programs or economic, necessarily economic policies? Why do people, why the situation of starvation? I know there's been a call to the United Nations World Food for food assistance for Mozambique, and recently there were protests about increase in prices for food.
Yeah, I mean, it's complicated, but basically, in rural Africa, the international policies, the agricultural and economic policies of the last 30 years have done two things. I think they've increased inequality, so that means the poorest rural areas are poorer, and also the support to agriculture has gone right down, both in monetary terms, but also the type of support. So as part of the structural adjustment policies, you saw grain marketing boards stopped. You saw agricultural extension cutbacks, all that kind of thing. And I think that's led to increasing problems with the poorest of rural poor in Africa.
Okay. We're listening to the voice of Dr. Julie Cliff. She's an Australian-born physician, public health specialist who moved to Mozambique from Tanzania in the mid-1970s. She works in the areas of infectious disease. She's on the faculty at Eduardo Mondlane University in Maputo. We're talking about some of her work around Konza, and we're going to move and talk a bit about malaria after I ask one other question. What impact do structural adjustment policies have on the area that you talk about, that you work in, which is health services, rural physicians, care without fees? How do you assess that?
Basically, in Mozambique, we've been able to hang on to care without fees, although it's very, there is a small fee, but it's tiny. So we've been able to hang on to that, but there have been pressures to stop it. But this is an ongoing saga because first the IMF capped health spending, and then what happened was because of all the lobbying, there's now big amounts of money going into health. First of all, it went into AIDS, but that was a very vertical program. Now there's more money going into health system strengthening as well. So you've had a lot more money coming in. So there's a battle going on about how that money should be directed, whether it should go to ministries of health and health services, or whether it should go to private organisations. And there's also a battle going on about the caps, and it's quite complicated.
Okay.
but they're caps with people saying for economic stability, the government can't spend too much on health, and therefore that limits the donor spending to health, and that's an ongoing struggle.
It must be interesting to be a healthcare, this be your area of specialty, and the notion of aid, quote unquote, is to help countries develop and to deal with critical areas of their development, social, political, economic. Mm-hmm. And then you have a cap, which actually exacerbates the situation that you're trying to address.
Yeah, it's extremely frustrating. And it's wrong. I mean, I think caps on health spending for economic reasons, when the money is potentially there, don't make sense to me. They really don't. I can't understand it.
Well, if you can't understand it, we probably won't. You won't get an answer from me here. You've also been focusing on the issue of malaria. Talk to us about how much of an impact does malaria have in Africa, particularly, and speak specifically about Mozambique. And generally, I know people know that HIV/AIDS has been disastrous for much of the African continent. And people also talk about tuberculosis and also about malaria. Talk about what malaria means.
Malaria is a major killing disease, and it was before HIV, continued during, you know, the worst phases of the HIV epidemic, and it's extremely serious. I mean, malaria is the number one killing disease in Mozambique.
Okay. Now, the paper you wrote was talking about different ways of addressing prevention around malaria. Talk a bit about that.
Okay. There's two main mosquito control strategies. One is spraying inside houses, and that's very effective in the right conditions. But, of course, you've got the problems of pesticides, etc. But, you know, it is effective. And the other is using bed nets for personal protection and household protection. And you can use them in combination, but there's been a lot of debate about which is the best method.
Okay. The university you teach at, Eduardo Monlon, just give us a sketch. Most of us have never been to Eduardo Monlon University. Give us a sketch of what the student body is, what the student academic load is in terms of the number of students that you have, and what the universities they've been able to do around issues of infectious disease, and just give us a sense of what Dr. Cliff does when you're in the classroom.
Okay, well, Eduardo Mondlane University is the first public university in Mozambique and still the main university. So it's a university with the oldest tradition in Mozambique, even though it's only 35 years old. And basically, I'm in the medical faculty. And for many years, we really struggled because the Portuguese left a disastrous situation. Because not only did they not train people to be doctors, for example, when I went there, there were hardly any Mozambican doctors. There were hardly any trained nurses. But also the whole primary and secondary education system, the school education system, was inadequate. So it's taken a very long time to catch up. And so for years in our medical faculty, we had a small faculty, and we were producing at the beginning, back in the 70s, you know, we were producing 6 or 8 graduates a year for a country of 12 million. Then the numbers crept up. And for about the next 20 years, we were only producing about 30 or 40 graduates a year, which was also really inadequate. But suddenly, about 5 or 6 years ago, we caught up. Something happened. I think finally the primary and secondary education, number of teachers you need, caught up. So We've now got over 100 graduates a year, but we still are really short of staff, funds, but we're producing a lot more doctors now.
Question as we get here to our last few moments. At some point, you left Australia and you decided to come to Mozambique. You've been there for 35 years, a lot of phases. Hasn't been easy. I'm sure there have been great times. There have been times that have been more difficult. What has all of this meant to Julie? I mean, most people, I'm saying that because most people, I think it's 90% of the American population, using this as an example, don't go more than 300 miles away from where they're born before they pass away. What has all of this meant to Julie?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, it's a bit different being an Australian. Because Australians travel. You know, we've got a tradition of you finish university, you go somewhere else. Okay. So that's partly it. But I think for me, people often ask me, you know, what are you going to do in the future? And I say, I never think about that. Because living in Mozambique, everybody lives day to day. You don't think about the future. You don't plan. So I see myself somehow as a person who lives day to day, who's gone to a place, who's found interesting work, satisfying life. And I've had a very rich, rewarding life in Mozambique.
And Julie, in the context of, not that any dream turns out to be perfect or any passion turns out to be perfect, but you initially went because of your thoughts about, hey, this offers a great opportunity. Mm-hmm. Southern Africa, change. This is a different, it's a different world. Mm. Your thoughts on how Julie has balances that at this point?
Yeah, it's difficult because obviously a lot of the dreams haven't been realized. But on the other hand, I have witnessed the building up of a health service that is still functioning, so that's very satisfying. I've witnessed the end of apartheid, which I think was probably one of the major recent events of world history. So that's all been very satisfying. And I was saying at Hesperian the other day, in some ways also I feel I've come full circle. You know, 30 years ago, I was a young doctor giving out copies of Where There Is No Doctor to primary healthcare workers. And, you know, here I am 30 years later, sitting in Hesperian working on a new edition of the book. And somehow that's satisfying as well, to think that there are still people, not just in Mozambique, but in other places, who are working for the same causes, motivated by the same ideals.
It's been a total pleasure. We've been talking with Dr. Julie Cliff, a public health specialist. She moved to Mozambique in the 1970s. She currently teaches the faculty on the faculty at Eduardo Molon University in Maputo. She's here in the Bay Area updating the book, Where There Is No Doctor. And if you want information on the work of Hesperian, you can go to www.hesperian.org, HESPERIAN.org, www.HESPERIAN.org. Julie, it's been a total pleasure.
Thank you.
Africa Today is produced by Walter Turner and is heard weekly on Pacifica Radio Station, KPFA, 94.1 FM in Berkeley. Thanks for listening.
$2,010 for free speech. KPFA is looking for 2010 subscribers between now and the end of the year. It doesn't matter if you're a current subscriber, or if you let your subscription lapse, or if you're a new subscriber. Visit kpfa.org today to be part of the 2010 for free speech. subscribers will be eligible for special thank you gifts like KPFA gear, a CD/DVD collection of KPFA's 2010 speaker series, the best of KPFA programming, and that's just a few. Visit kpfa.org and become one of 2010 for free speech in the year 2010.
You are in tune with listener-supported radio KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and online at www.kpfa.org. This is Transitions on Traditions.
Nia Imani Kujajakalia. Here's to the best words in the right place at the perfect time, to the human mind blown up and refined, to long conversations and the philosophical ramifications of